listening to a section of the Sunstone Summer Symposium session, originally recorded on Thursday, July 30th, 2015 at the University of Utah. Because of overwhelming demand, we have trimmed the audio for you to hear part of the session given by historian Christopher C. Smith, titled Four Views of Joseph Smith, Historians Debate the Prophet Puzzle. We encourage you to go to sunstone.org and search the audio tab for the title in order to listen to the entire conversation. Listening to the session in its entirety will give you the intended context needed to understand Christopher's remarks. The session, Four Views of Joseph Smith, was originally presented by Don Bradley, Ann Taves, Dan Vogel, and Christopher C. Smith. Each presenter was tasked with presenting a certain historical view on the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith, Jr. For the sake of this presentation, Christopher C. Smith represented the views of Joseph Smith as a fraud. Christopher C. Smith is a PhD candidate at Claremont Graduate University and is currently completing a dissertation on early Mormon views of Native Americans. He is the author of a dozen peer-reviewed articles, including one in a recent issue of the Journal of Mormon History. He runs the Mormon Studies blog Worlds Without End at withoutend.org. Christopher has mentioned that the research that you hear today in this presentation will eventually be published in a journal, so watch for Christopher's work and enjoy the presentation.
Joseph Smith was born into a petty crime family. How's that for an open mind? By the way, I'm going to say some deliberately provocative things here, but I'm not speaking out of malice. My goal is just to tell an interesting story in a way that you've never heard it before, and you can make of it what you will. And if any of this is hard to listen to, remember Don's up next. He's going to save the day. Okay, so petty crime family. His mother's second cousin was arrested for counterfeiting, and Joseph Smith Sr. seems to have narrowly escaped a counterfeiting conviction in 1807 by turning state's evidence. And in Palmyra, the Smiths' neighbors knew them as money diggers and knew them for stealing chickens and stealing other people's milk, milking their cows, and so forth. In the 1820s, Joseph read the memoirs of counterfeiter and con man Stephen Burroughs, as well as stories about pirate Captain Kidd. And he also practiced his own confidence games on his neighbors. He convinced them that with a seer stone that he stole from his neighbor Sally Chase, he could find buried treasure. On the promise of treasure, there was no treasure, but on the promise of treasure, they gave him money, food, and transportation. For instance, Joshua Stafford once gave him a sheep that he sacrificed in order to appease a treasure guardian, and that night the Smiths feasted on mutton. And I could tell you several stories like that. Thing is, the Smiths were poor. An 1829 visitor said that they ate rye bread for supper and burned through the only candle in the house that night. Stolen chickens and sacrificed sheep provided some protein, but Joseph dreamed of a really big score to lift his family out of poverty. So he came up with the Gold Bible. From the beginning, the Gold Bible was a for-profit enterprise. The Smiths often talked to their friends and neighbors about how much money they were going to make through this scheme. And the scam, as far as I've been able to figure it out, is Joseph would convince people that he had these plates, but he wasn't allowed to show anybody them yet. And he would publish a translation of the book and make a lot of money from selling, you know, copies of the book. And then with that money, he would actually forge a believable facsimile of golden plates, and he would exhibit those to tourists for a fee, for 25 cents a viewing. In Martin Harris, Joseph found the perfect mark for this scheme. The first time they met, Joseph said that God had promised him that the first honest man he met would give him $50, and Martin forked over the money. Here was a man of means that Joseph could manipulate. Joseph played on Martin's religiosity, but also on his greed. Martin was an investor. He mortgaged his farm for $3,000, and Joseph promised to quadruple that investment. But then Joseph received a revelation in 1830 that Martin was a wicked man and shouldn't get any of the profits. When Joseph sent people to sell the Canadian copyright of the Book of Mormon for $8,000, he told them to keep it secret from Martin. And a revelation designated the proceeds for the exclusive benefit of the Smith family. Dan Vogel argues that Joseph Smith was a pious fraud. I'm going to argue that he was an impious fraud motivated by money, sex, and power. Joseph probably did have some religious beliefs, but I don't think that religion motivated the fraud. If anything, I actually think it held him back a little bit. And we can see that in the quote that Dan gave us about Joseph saying that he was going to give up the seer stone as soon as he was done with translating the Book of Mormon. Because his family, particularly his in-laws, gave him a really hard time about the seer stones and so forth. And in 1827, he admitted to his father-in-law that peeping was all damn nonsense and promised to give it up and work hard for a living. And he briefly tried to keep this promise, moved to Pennsylvania, became a farmer, joined the Methodists, and then Oliver Cowdery showed up and convinced him to not only finish the Book of Mormon, but start a church. Joseph also wrestled with his demons a bit as he composed the Book of Mormon, and you can see this because the Book of Mormon condemns all of the things that he later becomes guilty of, all of his personal temptations, from polygamy and adultery to robbery, priestcraft, and murder. But ultimately, Joseph's beliefs shifted to fit his criminal behavior rather than his behavior shifting to fit his beliefs. By 1830, he was a universalist like Niebuhr, and by 1841, he was a moral nihilist like Korihor. He preached in 1841 that there was no sin where there was no accuser. In other words, anything goes as long as you don't get caught. He also taught that you have a right to get all you can. Morality probably didn't come naturally to Joseph Smith. A psychiatrist might diagnose him with antisocial personality disorder, which we colloquially know as psychopathy. One mark of a psychopath is uninterrupted eye contact. So normal people feel really uncomfortable with eye contact and they'll look away every few seconds, but a psychopath can just like stare you down. And one author of a book on sociopaths calls this the predator stare. And sustained eye contact is actually part of the psychopath's power because it makes them seem very charming and mysterious and seductive because normal people are just baffled by this power that they have to just make sustained eye contact. And so Parley Pratt described Joseph as having he described the serene and steady penetrating glance of Joseph Smith's eye as if he would probe the deepest abyss of the human heart and the mysteries of the universe. And both Stephen Harding and Joseph Jackson also said that the prophet stared steadily into their eyes. And to Joseph Jackson, Joseph Smith said, "Jackson, you are the first man I have ever met that I could not look down." Joseph Jackson was probably also a psychopath. Now look around the room and spot the psychopath. Every person I've told this to has either tried to stare me down or they've looked around really sometimes. Joseph didn't often show his true face. Fraud doesn't weigh on a psychopath the way that it weighs on a normal person. But once in a while, he couldn't resist a brag. Squire Butler once told Joseph he was astonished that a man of his appearance would attempt to palm off on the public a book which contained so many absurdities as the Book of Mormon. Joseph fired back, "I am astonished that a man of your intelligence don't know that the more absurdities there is connected with it, the readier people are to embrace it." In 1831, Joseph moved to Kirtland. Here, his activities took on an even more criminal aspect. He began developing a theology of theft, which for the rest of his life he would use to get his followers to engage in criminal activity. An 1831 revelation said, "I will consecrate the riches of the Gentiles unto my people who are of the house of Israel." Joseph also called this sucking the milk of the Gentiles, according to Newell K. Whitney's brother. One way he sucked the milk of the Gentiles was by printing his own money. He may have had a counterfeiting operation as early as 1834, run by Marvel Davis. But then in 1836, he realized that he didn't even need to break the law to print his own money, so he starts the Kirtland Bank. And basically, the Kirtland Bank created money and stock out of thin air and made large cash payouts to Joseph and Sidney without them ever actually depositing money into their accounts. Martin Harris called the bank a swindle, which was about right, and when the bank failed, church members bore most of the losses while church leaders jumped ship, transferred all their stock to a couple Fall Guys, and denied any responsibility for the bank or its failure. Joseph took a darker turn in 1835 when he decided to assassinate anti-Mormon Grandison Newell. First, Joseph asked Leonard Rich to kill Newell, but Rich refused. So then Joseph approached gunsmith Marvel Davis and his house servant Solomon Denton and told them that the murder was a great work and the will of heaven and they would be rewarded, and that once they killed Newell, they should hide the body. So Davis and Denton went to Newell's house. They saw him on his porch. Marvel Davis aimed his rifle at Newell, but he couldn't go through with it. He couldn't pull the trigger. And so they went back to Joseph, and Joseph told them he wished to God the deed had been done and hoped it wouldn't be given up. Later, Newell got wind of all of this, and he pressed charges against Joseph Smith for attempted murder in 1837. Before the trial, Joseph reportedly approached the assassins and asked them not to testify. Denton went ahead and testified, but Davis skipped the stake. For lack of evidence, Joseph was acquitted. But outside of court, both Davis and Leonard Rich confirmed that Joseph had attempted to recruit them for the assassination. Also, Apostles Orson Hyde and Luke Johnson, who were both in good standing at the time, both testified at the trial that they had heard Joseph say that it was the will of God that Newell should be put where the crows could not find him. So we have five witnesses who implicate Joseph Smith for this attempted murder, including two apostles in good standing. In 1838, Joseph and Sidney fled to far west Missouri. And in Missouri, Joseph organizes a group called the Danites, or the Daughter of Zion. Both these names come from biblical passages about Israelites stealing from the Gentiles and slaughtering them. The names imply that Joseph specifically designed the Danites as a robber band. Like the Gadiantans of the Book of Mormon, the Danites covenanted to lie, steal, and murder. They swore absolute obedience to the First Presidency, right or wrong, and they swore to put down all tattling and backbiting against church leaders. At one Danite meeting, Sidney Rigdon made the whole assembly swear to kill Gentiles and apostates on sight and throw their bodies into the brush. Rigdon claimed that one Gentile had already been murdered. On another occasion, Joseph, Hiram, and Sidney took 10 Danites outside the city and taught them that stealing from Gentiles was no sin, and if they got caught and put on trial, they should swear to a lie or do whatever else might be necessary to help each other out of trouble. The entire Danite theology, essentially, was designed to motivate criminal behavior. In fact, the Danite initiation ceremony was an early version of the temple endowment, complete with signs, penalties, grips, and keywords. Mormonism's most sacred ordinance originated right here as a ritual induction into a criminal conspiracy. The ceremony used a powerful combination of religious indoctrination, fraternal bonding, sacred oaths, and death threats to get normal, good-hearted people to do bad things. This wasn't criminal activity used in the service of religion. This was religion used in the service of criminal activity. Another tool in Joseph's motivational toolkit was blackmail. When he made polygamous marriage proposals, he sometimes told the women that he proposed to that he would ruin their reputations if they told anyone. And he actually did publish smears of women like Nancy Rigdon and Sarah Pratt, calling them whores and adulteresses. He also used the same tactics against male dissenters. In one sermon, he announced that he would publicly disgrace every man who didn't shut up and mind his own business. And in the Nauvoo City Council, once when Francis Higbee had warned William Law and William Marx that Joseph was going to assassinate them, Joseph told Higbee he should stay home and shut his mouth or else he would find the rumor mill turning against him. In 1838, Joseph's Danite shenanigans got him locked up, and while he was in jail, his brother William remarked to Heber C. Kimball, "Joseph ought to have been hung up by the neck years ago, and damn him, he will get it now." But William didn't get his wish because Joseph escaped and fled to Nauvoo. I'm running out of time here, so I won't say as much about Nauvoo, but basically, suffice to say, he secretly married 40 women, coordinated more robberies, counterfeiting, and assassinations, and continued to profit from his church office. In fact, in Nauvoo, he was the trustee and trust, and essentially all the church property for a few years was in his own name. One thing that Mormon historians say about Joseph is that he was a bad judge of character because all of his Nauvoo friends were criminals, basically. Personally, I think Joseph was a great judge of character and knew exactly how corrupt his friends were. For instance, he met Joseph Jackson, and a couple days after he meets Joseph Jackson, he records in his journal that Jackson is rotten-hearted, and then a few months later, he makes Jackson his personal aide-de-camp. Joseph Smith also appointed three Gentiles to the Council of 50, two of them known counterfeiters and one the inventor of a steam-powered flamethrower that Joseph wanted to buy the designs for. These dodgy Gentiles didn't get into the inner circle by accident. Joseph recruited them precisely because they had criminal expertise that he wanted to make use of. So to conclude, Joseph was basically a crook masquerading as a prophet, and he was very successful at it. By the end of his life, he had moved his family from the poorhouse to the mansion house, and he'd built a sprawling criminal organization designed as a church. Now, the story that I've just told is partly a cautionary tale. Turns out there are bad people in the world, and you have to be on your guard or you can get taken advantage of. And for me, this is counterintuitive because I'm actually a pretty trusting person. I like to believe the best about people. And so I've only sort of gradually moved from Dan's position to mine. And I think I've done it with some reluctance, despite a bit of admitted glee at sort of the craziness of all of this. But I think this can also be a hopeful story, because however bad Joseph was, his followers were mostly good and sincere people. And he may have founded Mormonism as a criminal front, but Mormons have made something very different out of it. So one way to look at Joseph's life is as the prologue to the much more ennobling story of how his followers have wrestled with his legacy and transformed it into something better. And Mormonism really is one of the great stories of institutional turnaround of the modern era. I mean, just how it went from the Mormonism of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young to the church that it is today is just an amazing story. So the good news is, the bad news is there are bad people, but the good news is that we collectively have the power to resist and redeem and transform whatever the bad people do. So go do that.
If you like what you've heard today, please join us at the Sunstone Summer Symposium this summer. The Sunstone Salt Lake Symposium is always held the last week in July. If you aren't in Utah, don't worry. Hundreds of Mormons and post-Mormons like yourself from all over the world fly in to attend this conference. Think of it as a giant Mormon Comic-Con with like-minded people. You'll meet the craziest, most interesting, diverse group of Mormons you could ever think of. And if you liked what you heard from Christopher today, Christopher Smith will be presenting two panels in a similar format at the July 2016 Summer Symposium. Get your tickets, group hotel rate information, and program schedule today at sunstone.org.